What is up, Hockey IQ listeners? I'm here to chat about our newest sponsor, Sensarena. Your brain is one of the most important parts of your body. Why not invest in a tool that allows you to train it? With Sensarena, athletes can gain a competitive edge using VR training. Players are able to go through a scenario thousands of times without having to step foot on the ice. No more waiting around for puck touches or perfect scenarios. Sensarena can enhance reaction time, decision-making, and multitasking abilities, making you the next MVP. I mean, if the LA Kings are using it, it's got to be good. With our promo code HockeyIQ, you receive $50 off an annual plan purchase. Head on over to sensarena.com to check it all out.
On the Hockey IQ podcast today, we bring on Larry Lauer.
Lauer is correct. Yeah, you
nailed it. Oh, I got it right the first time. All right. I am notoriously terrible at names, so I'll take this one.
Trust your instincts, Greg.
Yeah. So, Larry, super interested to have you on today. Obviously, you dip your toe into hockey, but your full time is mental performance in tennis with U.S. Tennis Association. So give maybe a quick 30-second background here, because we got a lot of places to go, and I'm going to dive straight into it.
Okay, great. So my role now is Director of Mental Performance at the United States Tennis Association, or specifically in player development, where our mission is to bring young players to becoming professional tennis players. And, you know, in our role, we prepare them mentally to perform. We work with our coaching staff as well. You know, for me, you know, my background is I have a PhD in exercise and sports science and sports psychology from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And I've been doing this for 20-some years. And, you know, years ago, spent time as a hockey director in Charlotte, Philadelphia, and did coaching education with USA Hockey. And then I had the fortune, through my consulting work, to work with USA Hockey's National Team Development Program in Ann Arbor, and I was working in Michigan State. I did that for almost 9 years. So that was an awesome experience as a consultant to the program. So spent a lot of time hockey years ago. Now my hockey work is more as kind of a coach, you know, with my son's teams, and definitely stay close to it. I try to work with, as a mental coach, with one hockey player a year, though, like you said, I'm full-time in tennis now, and just to keep kind of close to the game, to keep it sharp with hockey, but love the game, love talking about it, stay as close to it as I can.
All right, so you've worked with high-end tennis players and high-end hockey players, obviously, with the program. What are the similarities? What are some of the differences?
Well, I think that what we see is that these high-end players, they oftentimes, you know, they have obviously a very high skill level, probably a lot of confidence for where they're at. You know, they're pretty tough individuals usually, but there's a lot of individual differences here within these groups as well. But, you know, the best ones, though, Greg, are the ones that are conscientious. You know, they're taking care of all the details. You know, that's something you have to learn as a young player, developing teenager. You don't understand that, everything that goes into it. And that's what we try to do in our program. What they try to do at NTDP, which I think they do very successfully. You know, you're trying to show them what that path is going to look like, but you're still, you know, hard workers, conscientious, you know, taking care of the things that you're taking care of, being very prepared. You know, when does that light bulb come on? Depends on the player. We've had some that comes on when they go to college. Some they get it pretty early, and so that's. Just some of those individual differences. I think some of the biggest differences, you know, for the best hockey players that I've seen, the best tennis players, the individual nature of tennis, you know, really makes people a little bit more self-focused, a little more the experience is all about them, which, you know, that could come off as bad, but that's an individual sport. You know, in hockey, you know, the I would say the best players often are team players, where they're focused on the performance of the team as much as their own performance. They're trying to find ways to elevate their teammates. Communication in hockey has to be really good for you to be a successful team. Whereas in tennis, I think communication is very important, but you could have pretty poor communication skills and still excel as a tennis player. Because your relationship with your coach is, that one-on-one relationship is pretty intimate. So, that stuff can get worked out between you and your coach. But I do think it lowers your ceiling still as an individual sport athlete if you don't communicate well with your coaches and your support staff. But those are some of the big things I see. Hockey, I think the you would think like tennis, well, hockey players have to be really tough, and maybe you don't need to be as tough in tennis, but it's just a different kind of toughness where, we don't have the physical contact in tennis you have in hockey, but man, tennis is a tough sport with the speed of it, the time that's being played, the conditions, you don't have the same conditions every time. You might play in 100-degree weather, you might be playing in 50 in wind. And in tennis, it's all on you. All eyes are on you. If there's a mistake, it's on you. And everybody knows it, and you're the one that's responsible for it. So it definitely is, coaches will tell you, like, it's almost like you're out there by yourself, right? Like you really own that performance, which is a good thing, but also can create some anxiety, some pressure. So a lot of differences, a lot of similarities. That's why I've enjoyed working both. I enjoy team sports as well as individual sports because they do have some similarities and differences.
I liked what you mentioned there with hockey players. Like, they're trying to find ways to elevate others. The old edification, like, how do we best elevate others? And you think about it, like, it's such a good thing for sport, but also everything else in your life. Like, pretty sure you're not, winning a marriage if you're competing with your spouse or tearing each other down. Like, raise each other up. Same thing at work. Like, if you're raising other people, one, it's appreciated. Two, you're probably going towards what's best for the group, which is also best for yourself. So I love that elevating others being like a key aspect. And there's so many ways to do that. Like, you can skate for your teammates, like, open up space. You don't even need to touch a puck. Like, that's a fantastic way. Area passes, like, all these little details of how do you elevate others. And that's super, super massive in hockey. Obviously, tennis, a little more of an individual sport, but I mean, there's ways to do that. Elevate others around you to create more success and more opportunities.
Yeah,
I'm curious
definitely.
as to, like, when you're thinking about, like, the mental skills,
Mm-hmm.
like, what are the ones that you're seeing? We'll start with one, the high-end players, tennis and hockey that you've worked with, and then we'll bring it back to maybe the journey that your son's gone through of, like, what are the mental skills that they're maybe struggling with, and what are the things that we need to add to help them through things?
Yeah, so those mental skills are. They're pretty much the same no matter the level. Obviously, really young kids are just not developmentally doing all those things at complicated or abstract level. But so the way you talk to yourself, your self-talk, how you visualize and use imagery, your energy management, your stress management, breathing, is part of that. How you set goals to how they motivate you, how you focus, your how to use mindfulness to be focused and have your awareness. So there's a lot of different skills that could fall in this bucket of mental skills. And at the highest levels, what we see is a lot of times, especially for like teenagers, they haven't had to sharpen those mental skills if they've always been the best player coming through. They've been able to lean on their skills or their size or their speed, and they were just better. And so like for me at the National Team Development Program 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I had to fill that in for a lot of those players, right? Because they didn't need it until that point. But guess what? When they got there, they needed it. Because now you're playing older guys, you're playing junior teams, you're playing college, university teams into best players in the world. So you pretty quickly realize that, you know, your confidence takes a shot, right? Even out of the gate where, you know, you're getting beat up sometimes and you're coming out of the gate, but playing these older players, but, you know, those high-end players, they have, you know, what we've seen typically is there is a confidence about them, a belief that they can get it done. You know, that's a big part for many of those players. You know, another thing probably that, you know, that they could improve in many cases is probably their focus. Honestly, that's more of a societal thing than, say, just hockey. But being able to focus in the present on the task at hand is huge. That's really where mental performance comes back to all the time, is can you stay present and do what's needed to be done right now to perform? And, you know, with all the different distractions that young kids have, I think that's something that we have to teach. You know, being able to keep your focus and refocusing really well throughout, you know, a 60-minute game. You know, where else do they really, are they being pressured to do that? So we got to teach that. So that to me is a big thing that we got to focus on. We got to focus on how to handle stress, because the expectations grow pretty quickly for our best players. You know, you think about it, you know, you're playing your small town where you grow up and you're the best player. You know, you have a lot of expectations, but you're probably just better than other guys, so you're able to uphold those expectations. But when you're playing the best players, your peers in the world and in the country, things can get challenged very quickly, as it should. This is a good thing, but it creates a lot of stress. You know, so we have to teach our players how to look at stress. That stress is actually our friend. Stress is useful. It creates growth. And that's telling us that there are demands upon us, and how are we going to cope with that? Now, unrelenting, you know, not useful stress, like being mean to players, for example, those things aren't necessary. We don't need to do that to create stress. The game creates stress. It is the scoreboard, the speed, the talent, the skill. So, but those are things that I focus on a lot, and what we try to do, whether it was when I was in hockey, much more than I am now, was to focus on developing routines that the players could integrate these mental skills into the performance. That's the key, because, you know, sports psychology, where it maybe has come up short in many ways, is that we can do a better job of showing the consumers how can you take breathing, for example, in a way that it's useful and help you focus and clear your mind and recover. How do you bring that into performance? How do you bring imagery into the performance? And that's something that I've tried to focus on a lot in my career, in tennis and in hockey and in some other sports. And that's something that has to be done for our players to excel at the mental game. But I would say, just to sum that up, Greg, you know, a lot of times those high-end players have a lot of confidence. You know, many of them are very hard workers, and, you know, they do a lot of things right. But then they might be lacking in some other areas, which is totally normal, like focus, potentially knowing how to handle stress, because maybe they are adversity, because they haven't had to deal with that a lot. So we have to build up their resilience muscle, you know, because they haven't dealt with a lot of adversity.
Yeah, I find the stress piece to be an interesting one, because I know a few people in my personal life where, like, they think that removing all stress is the answer, rather than managing the stress that we currently have and reframing it a positive. Like, I just got to get out of all the stress, get out of the stressful situation, all of this. And it's more so almost like, I mean, some of it's avoidance, but some of it's just like, oh, my problems will be solved if I'm not stressed, or I'll be able to deal with life better if I'm not stressed, which we all know there's always going to be a stressor of some sort. So how do we put that into our life in a positive manner? And the other one that really resonated with me that you're talking about is self-talk. We all have an inner dialogue of sorts. And how do we develop that to be something that is in our favor rather than doesn't hurt us? Because, if you're beating yourself up over you passed a puck right up the middle on a pizza to the other team for a breakaway, probably not helpful. Or just, a small mistake and suddenly, like, oh, I'm terrible. I'm like, we had Marty St. Louis on this podcast. He's like, I never played a perfect game. Like the closest I ever got to it is I only made 3 mistakes in a game. He's like, you're constantly making mistakes. So I'm really curious to hear about, how you're going about developing better self-talk, because obviously that's part of the mindset, making sure we're in a healthy space to deal with the stress, the ability to have that mental toughness, which for me is like the ability to focus on the next most important thing. So self-talk, I think, is the number one thing that I'd love to dive in next.
Sure. Well, when we try to put that in the context or in the frame of stress, right? And try to teach what that means to our players. What is stress and how do you experience it? And we talk about the gym a lot and training. It's like you're stressing your body, and when you lift weights, you run, whatever you're doing, you're breaking those muscles down. Recovery, they build back up and they're stronger. They can do more and they adapt over time. And we liken that then to the mental side, the psychology, that anything in life that probably is important to you, you're going to experience stress. It's going to be with you all the way. So why not let's look at this in an adaptive way as something that I expect, I accept, and I embrace. Now again, there's forms of stress that are not useful and are unnecessary. But the ones that are inherent to what you're trying to do, those are the ones you want to incorporate into your training. Have your players experience them where they can be coached, where they can be supported, where you can challenge them, and you can hold them accountable to use the skills you've been teaching them. And so that to me, everything, it kind of starts with that. We've been challenged sometimes, like with the approach I use. Why do you talk about stress at a young age? Like, well, because everybody deals with it. But if you're ineffective at coping with it, it's going to affect not only your tennis, your hockey, but it's going to affect your quality of life, as you're talking about, Greg. So we start there, and then we show them this diagram, this cycle, that you experience demands at all times. Sometimes they're small, sometimes there's a lot of demands, right? And then there's how you think about those demands. And that's really the key, right? If I said, okay, we're going to climb a mountain together, and you ask me, well, what are your experiences and skills on this area? I have none, but we're going to do this. We're going to climb Mount Everest. You would probably have a perception of that that wouldn't be very positive. But then there's some risk takers out there, like, I'm with you. Let's do it. It's going to be fun. Most people be like, yeah, that's about it. How you look at the demands makes all the difference. And you see that in your team. Some kids, some players, if you're playing another good team, for example, maybe you get down early, they might be ready to pull the chute and pack it in because, well, we can't do this. It's too much. And others are like, okay, let's dig in. We got to get the next goal. We just got to keep working. And so people are going to respond to these demands in different ways. And what we try to do is bring that to the surface. What are your tendencies? And this is where it gets into that inner talk or that dialogue, right? Where you have habits in the way that you think. And those risk takers have habits in terms of, like, they want that excitement. They want that opportunity to be in that stressful situation where people who are risk averse feel threatened. You're almost like that, trade anxiety. They want to be out of that situation. It's uncomfortable. There's too much threat, right? So how you look at the threats, the risks versus the rewards is really important here. But there's two main questions that are going to determine how much stress you experience. One is, how important is the consequences of what you're doing? And number two, can you cope with it? Do you have what it takes? This is where you can get into self-efficacy or confidence, but how am I thinking about those demands? Now, this thinking, this internal dialogue, because it's so almost subconscious, and there's a lot of habits built in there, Greg, that oftentimes you're not really aware. It's happening, but you're not thinking about your thinking. You're just rolling with it. And so then you get these emotions that come out and these physical responses that you have that then drive behavior, right? So the way we talk to the players about this is that you're always experiencing demands, sometimes more than others. How you think about that is the key. That's what we have to get at. How are we looking at what we're experiencing? Your thoughts drive the bus, but your emotions try to hijack the bus. So your thoughts might be, you might have a game plan, and you're trying to go this direction, and then you take a punch early in the game. You know, I'm saying that, you know, not actually, but, you know, you get down two goals, and then suddenly your emotions take you on the left turn. Like, we're going down this right now. We're going to stop playing defense, and it's going to be all about taking chances, you know, giving up two-on-ones and odd man chances. So I think that you got to make the players aware of that cycle. And of course, you know, as you can imagine, you know, it's demands leading to your thoughts, leading to your emotions and your physical responses, then leading to your behavior. Those things cycle back into your demands, because if you deal with, let's say, being down two goals early in a poor way, you're probably going to make the situation worse. And now you've got more demands, you're experiencing more stress. If you deal with it in a good way, you can stop that cycle, get it going in another direction. Now, that's self-talk, and we can dive deeper more into that side of things. We try to really, our team at USA, what we try to do is focus the players on a few really important things in terms of how they think. The first is always being present with what you're talking about, right? Now, there's times to go in the past, there's times to go in the future, but as you're performing, you want to spend the majority of the time in the present, and that's been borne out in many studies, and over the years we've known that. You know, the zone and flow is about being present. Secondly, you want to focus on purpose, right? You want to be focused on your purpose. What's my task right now that I need to do? That task can change quickly, but I have a purpose. I have key things, you know, that I'm focused on. You also want to be focused on your process, the way you do things. So again, from a mental performance standpoint in hockey, when I come to the bench, I still have a job to do. And people don't necessarily think about that. When I come to the bench, my job is to recover, learn from my shifts, talk to my line, and get ready to go again and watch a play. So I'm engaged in the game, right? So you have multiple things you're doing. And then if you're dealing with something, you're angry because you turned over the puck, you've got to get over it. You got to let that go. And you got to focus on what you will do versus what you're trying to avoid. That's all about that self-talk, right? What are you saying to yourself in that moment? And so you have to work that time period. And so, you know, do you have a process for letting go, for example, of your mistakes and focusing on what you're going to do next? Very powerful, very important. So what's your process? Focusing on your process, especially under adversity, going to your routines, going to your, you know, the things that are going to allow you to be successful. Coaches will say that as like fundamentals, right, too. You know, what are my steps for playing this game where I'll be successful? You know, so those things are key. And then probably the listeners will say, well, what about positive, Larry? Yeah, positive is one of those four P's that we talk about for your self-talk, but not like unicorns and rainbows positive, but more positive action. What's the action going to take? There's an energy about you. It doesn't always have to be that you're happy-go-lucky, because that's just not hockey. It's just not tennis. It can be at times, but you can be angry and be positive if you're focusing that anger on supporting your teammates, if you're focusing on anger, skating and moving your feet, back checking up the middle, getting whatever it is, right? Getting back. So that positive is different than probably what people think, that everything's good. Well, actually, we're not in a good spot, but we're going to do this. We're going to do A, B, and C to get back in this game. That's much more productive than someone who's like, oh, everything's good. No, we're down three goals. Things aren't going very well now, but we can find a way by doing these things. So we try to teach the players to think in these ways. The way we do it is through a lot of journaling, a lot of goal setting, and a lot of reflection on the practices and the performances.
All right. So the thing that popped out there, you talked about positivity. So I want to go there next and kind of through the coaching lens of like coaching positively versus we'll say punishments on the other end. So like, you know, a lot of coaches love a good bag skate still. Like things aren't going well. Let's get on the line and do a suicide skater, you know, the old Herb Brooks, the Herbies. Yeah. So what's your take on, you know, positivity versus negativity type coaching and how we go about that?
Yeah, anyone that's listened to me talk before on our podcast, who do Compete Like a Champion or talks that I've done, I'm not a big fan of using skating or running for a punishment, especially for children, because we're trying to help them fall in love with the game and enjoy moving. And, you know, I'm talking to our strength conditioning team as well. You know, they want the players to feel like it's a privilege to be able to go and train with them, right? That running 200 meters is a good thing versus like, oh, it's a punishment, right? So there's that piece of it. I know as players get older, maybe that's not as relevant, you know, because they've kind of formed a lot of their opinions. However, nonetheless, we want to create an environment where players feel supported and feel like they can make mistakes and they're being coached. To me, when I start doing that as a coach, my players aren't listening to me. Now they're dealing with sort of the adversity, the struggle. Oh, now they're going to do these skates and they're just trying to get through it. Where's the learning occurring, right? And I think the trap here, Greg, is that for coaches that you will get the behavior that you want right away, probably, if they can do it. If you bag skate them, if you do walls, you know, whatever you're going to call it. But the learning's not there, right? It becomes a reversive thing. The player's like, yeah, I'm going to basically do this now for you, but I'm not going to do it later. And they might not have been thinking those words, but you're taking something that you want, you're turning it into a negative. You know, for me, I don't want to coach that way. I want to do those things that way. I want to get creative, right? How do I find a way to get these players to do what we all want them to do? And through a lot of coaching, through challenging, through different games, through, you know, try to reward the behavior you want more than providing consequences. The consequences are, for me, are different than punishments, though, because we might say, all right, we're playing small game, and if you, you know, turn over the puck, you lose a point, right? Now, yeah, I might not play that a lot because I want my players taking chances to make plays, but let's say there's a specific kind of turnover we're trying to avoid, like just absolutely throwing a bomb back to the point, right? The puck's bouncing all over the place because we didn't settle it down and make a nice pass, flat pass to our D. So we might do that sometimes as a consequence. That's different than just flat out punishment of I'm going to provide this negative experience because I'm not getting what I'm. Not a lot of learning occurs there. What you want is your players learning and having an open mind to you. And I think that oftentimes shuts players down.
Yeah, I love what you mentioned there about just rewarding what you want to see. Like even doing like film, like showing something that you want to see more often rather than avoiding this. Just showing maybe an example of a player on the, for hockey terms, like a player doing it right. So, you know, proper center support on the breakout. Show a guy who does it right. And that usually is going to work a lot better than showing someone who's doing it wrong. Because, okay, you're showing them what to do or what not to do, but then it still doesn't maybe give them enough ideas, especially if they're on the younger side, of what should I be looking to do or what are some like maybe some patterns of what good looks like. Yeah. And that's super difficult to go with.
If I can add to that, Greg,
yeah,
just briefly, that's one of the fundamental things that we must do as coaches to train our players' minds how to think. You know, how do we structure the way you're thinking on the ice? And our brains don't compute, don't. So if we say don't turn over the puck, the first thing that goes through most people's minds is turnover. Because the brain computes action, right? It's not computing the don't part of that statement. So then you start going into avoidance mode, which typically most vast majority of time, that's not good for players, not good for teams. So we have to tell our players what it is that we want, right? Or they need to tell us. We have to train them to tell that for them to tell us, like, okay, what are your goals today? Well, I don't want to turn over the puck. All right, we need to adjust that goal because that's going to maybe make you play hesitant, avoid trying to make plays. Maybe you're just going to get rid of the puck as soon as you get it because you don't want to make a mistake. Let's change that. How do we change? Let's focus on the actions you will take, right? I want to make tape-to-tape passes. I'm going to get my feet going with my head up and find the open man. Try to change that goal in such a way it tells them what to do, like you're saying. And video is great for that. I have never found focusing on just on what people are doing wrong to be a good teacher because it doesn't tell them what to do.
Drives me wild when people aren't specific when they're coaching. Like, we got to work harder. Like, okay, well, what does that mean? A player has no idea what it means. You're like, we need to work harder. Like, okay, that is you are taking the lazy road out, whether you realize it or not. And players are just that's not it's super ineffective. It's terrible.
Yeah, and that's again where, Greg, we can use the game, right? So if you want the players to work harder, why not play like 2-on-2s in a small area and puck battles and, put them in situations where they have to work hard, right? Or maybe you're working on a game where they have to back check and get back into play, right? Really move their feet. But to me, that's a fun another fundamental error that you're bringing up in coaching is not being specific. If focusing on a negative is one, definitely not being specific is another.
All right, cool. Glad you and I are on the same page there because it
We're on the
drives
same
me
page.
wild whenever I'm like watching someone coach or like someone's asking for my feedback going to their coach, like, watching their practice or whatever. Those are like first two things. Like, you're not being specific enough. The players have no idea. Another one is like not checking for understanding. Like, do your players actually know?
Good
The
point.
next place I want to go here is you're talking about a lot of like the players getting to their process. I feel like a lot of times coaches coach the outcome rather than coaching the process. So I'll leave it at that and let you take it where you want. But I think there's a disconnect between coaching results versus coaching inputs and process.
Boy, I can go a lot of ways with this, Greg. I think about it, talk about this a lot. Even if folks have been watching the NFL this year, for example, you hear players and coaches talking about, just kind of the next game, the just being focused in the present, right? And then focused on what your processes are. And a very famous, maybe the most successful coach in college football, Nick Saban, just retired, talked about the process all the time, didn't he? About what are you doing on this play to be successful, to make your team successful? Do you know what those details are? Are you executing those? And, I think that a lot of that came from early on too. He talked about how he was at Michigan State, and the psychiatrist there, talk about how you want to be present and preparing for the next play, and that was the key to success, not focusing on winning the outcome. And to me, the outcome obviously is what people want at the end of the day. We do play to win the game, I understand that. But if you take a bigger picture look at it, it's more important in the way that you play, in the way you do things, because the process always leads to the outcome. And that's why we're always trying to focus back to the process, because the outcome is always, almost always, very much on the forefront of people's minds, right? We want to win today. Yeah, well, how are we going to do that? It's my next question. How are we doing that? That's where I want to focus. So I think sometimes people get the idea that sports psychology, mental coach, professionals, they poo-poo winning. I mean, what it's about is the process you can be successful. And that success may not end up winning today, but the way you're doing things is going to allow you to win long term, to win more often. And that's the way we got to focus. So this is a very important message, Joe, because I think that people get the wrong message from watching sport on TV. All about winning, winning the big game. Yeah, of course, but they don't see all the preparation that goes on that these athletes are doing to prepare for the game, to prepare for that playoff series. And you will hear players, if you listen to them, talk about these things that, okay, when the NHL playoffs, you can't get hung up on any one game because you're going to have some bad games. You're going to have games where you don't play well. You're going to have periods where you don't play well or shifts. It happens. You need to be resilient. That's the key. To me, when we focus solely on outcome or mostly on outcome, we place pressure on our players. We create anxiety. We take the focus off performing what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to execute. We put it on how am I beating this other guy in front of me? Am I or am I not? And the issue with all this is that the outcomes are never under control. We would like them to be. We would like to think, well, if we prepare this way, then we'll win. Hey, guess what? You might not win. Because the other team might just be better that day. You know what? Their goalie might be hot, or maybe you just get a bad bounce or a bad call at the right time for the other team to win. That happens. We see it all the time. So what we have to focus on is what the players control. Because that is what gets us to the outcome that we seek always. Process becomes before the product, before the outcome. That is how you get what you want, is the way you do things. And you've got to train that into the player's mind every single day. I know what we do, and I learned this really. This is something we were doing at the NTDP at USA Hockey. What are those three key things you're going to do going into the game to be successful? As an individual playing your role and as a team. And that to me is the key. Can you turn the radar of your mind towards your process? These are how-to goals, how I'm going to play, how I'm going to compete, how I'm going to be a good teammate. And the outcome is always there. We always want to win, typically, especially with high-achieving players. You don't have to worry about that. So we just need to move that radar over to our process and try to keep it there through the way we're setting our goals before we ever step on the ice.
Yeah, and I find sometimes it can be challenging, one, from coaches, but two, even for players coaching themselves per se, of where they get a little bit too competitive, where like I've had success doing this, so I always go back to this well over and over again, even though it may not be working, or they play then too conservative because they don't want to lose so bad that, they just don't want to make a mistake, which both of those lead to obviously sub optimal performance that would actually propel them. So playing it too safe or going back to the same thing that brought them success in the past can be a big problem. I'm assuming you've seen that a few times.
Oh, many times, many, many times. And, as we say a lot to our coaches and players, that every single day around someone's losing a lead because they're playing hesitant, because they're avoiding and trying to avoid losing versus going and taking the opportunity and taking it, really kind of taking it by the neck, if you want to say, and sealing the deal. So, for me in hockey, in the media say the worst lead is 2-0 or 2-goal lead. There's a reason that there's a phenomenon behind that, and that is typically when we get off, we start to try to protect what we have. And you have to change that. You have to keep attacking. This is why the Tampa Bay Lightning, back when Tortorella was there, talked about safe as death, right? And I think the Penguins and other teams have made a just a turn into a profession possessing the puck. That's how we play defense. I mean, obviously that's not the only way, but we're going to be able to possess the puck so the team's just not in our zone that much. And that's playing to take the game versus avoiding, protecting. Again, it's a natural human phenomenon to try to protect what you have. What you have to change that mindset is we got to be relentless. Now we got to be smart. I don't mean, just taking a lot of risk when you're up, not necessarily, but you got to stay in your game. You got to stay aggressive. You still have to forecheck. You still have to try to make plays. You don't necessarily need to make a move at the blue line when you're last guy back. I don't say that. Again, when you're working youth hockey, it's fine, but be creative. But at the same time, there are plays to be made, and we should continue to look to make those. And that's where you're coaching them to go and take it, and that's a much better way to attack that situation than trying to avoid or protect.
All right, we've got two big areas to go. I want to start with just from a developmental like pathway type thing, where hockey is a late development sport. You're like, why is that? Tennis might be a little bit less of that than most, and why is that?
That's a great question, and there can be multiple reasons for that. I think one thing we think about is the physicality of the game, what it takes to be successful. Hockey being a physical game, a collision sport, you're gonna have to build these players up and get them to a level where they can compete with those older players. What I saw at the National Team Development Program. You can have a team of 17-year-old boys who can compete with junior teams and college teams for sure and beat those teams. But those are the best of the best. I mean, those guys are, many of them are being drafted into the NHL in their 18 years. So, that's one level. But to me, it's the physicality of the game. But that doesn't answer the whole question that you asked. I think it's also being able to think the game. Because the game is so fast and the upper level is so skilled that you need a lot of experiences in that environment to really learn how to think it, to anticipate, to be aware of what you're doing, what your teammates are doing, what your opponents are doing. That's where any team should make, planning and goal setting before games and post-game reflection just part of their culture. Habit because you need your players to learn what it's going to take to be successful at that level. And it's going to come from setting your focus and then reflecting on that, which I mean goal setting, right, on the process and then reflecting on how you did on those things. So tennis, if we look at that because of the way the sport's played, especially with girls, they can go in. The best of the best can go at a younger age, look like Coco Gauff, for example, and be successful at a younger age. Maybe it has to do with the physicality. Maybe it has to do with, you're the only one on court, so you're not relying for other people to perform and a whole team, including the goalies. So, it's a different animal in that individual sport where you can do things at a high level. Like I see some of our kids at 13, and I'm amazed at how well they hit the ball. I can't imagine hitting a ball that good, and they're 13. And they're allowed to do that, right? Because there's nobody on their side of the net trying to hit them or take their stick from them, right? No one's grabbing their racket or bumping them as they're trying to hit the ball. That's not that kind of interference. Now, there's different forms, like the way the person moves the ball around, kind of spins, trajectories, height, that kind of thing. But for the most part, I have more control of what we do. And so I think there's a number of things that go into why hockey would be a later development sport. I love that because it gives players time to develop. One of the biggest things we have to try to avoid in tennis is just predetermining. All right, this kid's big. They hit a big ball. They're 14. Therefore, they're the one that's going to make it. Doesn't typically go that way. You know the numbers, right? A lot of times, still your best players, they're developing at 15 and 16, and so, they may not pop until they're 16, 17, right? Now, what I told you before, I think before we started recording was, we do see probably the players who are going to make top 10. They're playing at a pretty high level in Europe. if they're a girl up to 14, 15, 16, talking about playing pro events, international events. But those are kind of the rare people, right? Most of us need to go through that development trajectory and have that experience over time. So it's very easy to get impatient in this development pathway, Greg, as you probably see. People think that their path needs to be, my path needs to be like, I'm not going to say Bedard because that's, I mean, that's once, twice in a generation, but a guy who's been drafted, right? If they're a pretty good player, they're looking to play pro. Everybody's paths are going to be different. You have the general principles that you're looking at. The players need to be able to do certain things by a certain age, but as we tell the tennis players too, there's different pathways to get to where you want to be. And your pathway doesn't have to look like Rafa Nadal's because that's just Serena Williams. It's probably unrealistic. Could it happen? Yes, but it happens like once a generation. So what we got to focus on is how do we help you keep getting better and performing.
So I find that there's stubbornness in a lot of great athletes. Like there's a level of stubbornness. But then it comes to a point where it might get a bit extreme where, and I know every coach has dealt with a player, at least one of them, that is constantly giving excuses of sorts. You're talking about something simple like center breakout support. Now they've got an excuse. Well, I'm doing this because of this. And you're like, well, that's not where your brain should be. And there's always an excuse. How do you deal with players that like give excuses for themselves? Or what I always love is the I try. I tried. I tried, coach. Well, okay, you're focusing on the trying part rather than the doing. Like just do it and get it done rather than the I tried. And like that's like the ultimate excuse, the I tried. When you really don't.
It's funny because we did a podcast a while back, excuses on compete like a champion. And I don't know how people took that, but one of the messages that we were delivering, my co-host Johnny and I, was that, when we start talking about excuses, we're, kind of placing blame. So as a coach, it's better to talk about sort of factors in performance and what do we control and what we don't. But for sure, players make excuses. Everybody does. They're going to make excuses. What we have to do is be really clear on what our expectations are and be able to connect A to B, right? Like, okay, yeah, that's that support that you want to provide there because you're in this spot in the ice. What does that do for your teammate now? Now he doesn't have an out. Now he's stuck along the board trying to protect the puck, right? He's getting hit. So trying to connect A to B, talking it out with the player, getting to hear what they have to think, what their thought process is on as well, so that they know that their opinions are appreciated. That's important to be able to get through. But yeah, a lot of really great players are stubborn, where they, and that's part of what makes them good, is they have a lot of belief. They're very determined. They think they know what they need to do. In many cases, they do. Where it becomes a detriment to them is where, like you said, take it so far that they're not being coachable. They're not open to the feedback. But what I've seen from the best who manage that stubbornness is that they're not going to allow that to get in the way of getting better. Now, they might challenge you more, but if it's the right thing to do, they're going to get it. And they're going to do it because they just want to get better. They want to be the best they can be. It's not about being right. It's about being the best they can be. And that to me is the big point here, right? That I'm going to do what it takes to be the best I can be. So if my coach is telling me I should do this, I'm going to try it. Now, you got to be prepared. They might come back to you and say that's a load of crap too. But if you're doing your job as a coach, I think they're going to see, why you're telling them that. And you need to explain that too. But for sure that, you want your players to push back on some level. That means they're thinking about it. They're being critical thinkers versus just being like, yep, coach, yep, coach. And then not really thinking the game. But again, going back to the excuses, people make them often because they're trying to protect their ego. And we have to break that down. Look, put yourself out there, do this, 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 and this, and the performance will get better. You might not win. Can't guarantee that you're going to win, but you're going to feel better about the way you're performing. So yeah, those excuses, or I just tried, great. When you're eight, I guess maybe the try comment can work maybe, but at some point you got to do, you got to go and do the job, and especially if you want to be a high performer. So there's nothing wrong in making mistakes, making errors. That's how you learn, and that's how we have to teach our players to think about it, but be determined to make the next play. Stay with it, really hang in there. Don't make the excuse, well, the referee didn't call that hook. You have no control over that.
All right, so the last piece I really want to go here is kind of about like well, there's the two little pieces here. Just kind of the idea. First piece is just like starting ready. Like, always kills me when we step on the ice, right? Like, we only have an hour or an hour and a half, whatever your practice is, and the first like 5 minutes is messing around, or we're stretching, or we're not like jumping in, and then we wonder why our teams, they don't start ready on, or they don't start on time. Like, I love just immediately starting into practice. We're boom, we're going right after it. We're doing one-on-one puck protection or something to get the blood flowing, or we'll do power play PK, somewhere we really got to focus up right away on technical details, tactical details. So I'm curious on, what does that look like for you? Just making sure we're mentally ready and prepared to start on time rather than 5 minutes in or after the first period.
Yeah, I know some people think we're crazy, but even with our house league team, we have them come in 45 minutes early. Let them just hang out, play music, joke around, start getting ready. And then we'll talk them through the practice. Here's what to expect. Because we don't get a lot of ice time here in Florida. I'm going over some concepts, maybe spacing, for example, concepts that I don't want to take a lot of time to talk about on the ice. And then there's just expectations that are created, that, okay, when we start to practice today, here's what the warm up needs to be. We need to get moving. I would say with, higher level travel, like the national team that I have a chance to be around, that preparation is occurring well before you step on the ice, that you're getting moving, you're stretching. You're aware of what your goals are that day. You're visualizing what you're going to do when you go out there. You are getting the mind locked in. As coaches, we have to teach them the routines that are going to have them be ready. I know in tennis, we try to make those as close to what they're going to do on match day as possible, so there's a level of comfort. And I think the same thing can apply in hockey. We're going to do these kinds of things to get ourselves ready. Trying to keep those pregame talks pretty concise and focused, so players don't start to wonder. That's important. That's something that I would like to, even on our team, see better this upcoming season. And again, once you step on the ice, just delivering that energy and enthusiasm from going on there. Okay, it's time to go. And like what you said about jumping into a puck protection. Well, for me, this is a teaching thing for your players. That when you drive a car and you enter the highway, speed is 65. If you enter the highway at 30, you're going to get run over. And if you enter the highway at 90, you're going to run somebody. You need to find that optimal energy and know what it feels like when you start to practice. So when you go to games, you know how to get yourself ready so you can perform from the first shift. That's really what one of the main things we can learn from practice is, how do I get myself ready to go, energized, alert, focused on the present, ready to play? That should be a part of this for our hockey teams that are playing competitively. That's a process. Preparation's not something that there's a formula per se that every player has to do the same thing. Of course not. There's preferences. People do different things, but there are some principles. From a mental standpoint, we ask them to know what their goals are. have a plan of how you're going to achieve them and visualize being successful. Really, not just physically getting ready, but mentally locking in. That process of not only physically getting your body moving, but mentally becoming aware of what you're doing and removing the other distractions and noise from the day, you're going to come out better. You're going to come out more prepared. And again, I think if you put an emphasis as a coach, if we've done everything, the dynamic warm-up, for example, coming out and doing something competitive sends a message to your players and you need to start on time. I know a lot of programs, first 15 minutes, we're going to skate up and down in lines. I don't like it. I know I just saw your recent post on this, so, but, sometimes you're battling to try and change that mentality. In my association, I'm not, because if we have two teams in the ice, I can't necessarily dictate that we're all going to do puck protection games to start. But what I can do is say, okay, we're going to skate and everybody's going to skate at the same time and I'm going to make them do different movements. Or actually, what I hope to do is play maybe like tag, something like that going into the new season just to make it fun and make it challenging. But it's how you start on time. So you have to look at the way your practice, your pre-practice and your practice starts. Are you training that brain to be ready to go? Train that body ready to go. And if you're taking the first 10 minutes to talk about what the practice is, you're not doing it. You've got to be planned and you have to explain it, pre-practice, and teach your players what you want them to be doing from the first time they get to the rink to when they step on the ice.
Or at least, sometimes that can be challenging and build the complexity. Just don't go straight there. We start 3-on-3 cross ice, then we add a rule, and we add a constraint, and go there. So yeah, I love that. And just like the phys, like I hate the warm up with the they call. I know there's a million words for it. I call it the pretzel, where you start two guys in a corner, one goes out above the circle, you make the pass, they go in and shoot, and then you go around. Like one, I can't think of much worse physically. Like you're having so few people moving, even with the movement patterns, it's so terrible. And then mentally, like we're not even coming close to what it's going to look like in the game. So that drives me crazy. And then yeah, you with I mean, I was rolling my eyes in the background over here. Obviously, you saw it. No one else can see it, but you just with the lines, like oh, just terrible. Like tag's great. I like where you're going. Tag's great. Yeah, just drives me wild. So I love that. Just like starting ready and just anything mental to just like, all right, you have to be ready. Or like with my kids, I've got a lot of high schoolers that are very young. Most of our team is sophomores and freshmen. So it's like, all right, I'm just gonna throw you in the deep end or right away. So you gotta be locked in and just, ways that we can go about that.
Can I follow up on that, Greg, before
Absolutely.
we go on? Because there's probably a lot of young coaches listening to this too, or coaches trying to get into it. And I like this idea of how to start. Understand that you're working against the tradition of the way people do things. And so when I came, other coaches are running skating. I can't just come in and be like, that's stupid, don't do that, because they're just going to blow me off. Who am I, right? Like, I'm just another hockey dad. Versus like trying to take time, explain to people another approach, try to show it to them. One day I looked at that, doing the lines, and I said, hey, realize we did that for 12 minutes, but the kids on average were moving like 1 minute. That's all the movement that they got out of 12 minutes, a minute and a half. Like, that's just not effective use of our time. And trying to change people's minds on how we do these things. We implemented something. I think people still think we're crazy. I call it chaos. But after they do have to do the skating warm up at our association first, but then it's okay. You come down, you get a puck. We're throwing out a bunch of barriers and stuff. Everybody's skating in the zone all around. And it's teaching them to have the head up. And again, remember, this is, 15U house league. So it's teaching them many things, how to make quick moves with the puck, how their head up, communicate. We love doing that. Even it's just 5 minutes, just to kind of get their eyes alert and their feet moving before we jump into anything else. But the other thing I'll say on that too is, we've used that pretzel, or, I've heard it called horseshoe. I'm asking to change that because I'm not a big fan of it, because I'm looking at the time spent moving, and it's just not enough. You got to get the feet going, because a lot of these kids too, it's not like they have a practice skate before they play a game, so they're not getting to go out and hit the ice before they step on the ice for their game. So that whatever time is given to them, and well, you got to take advantage of it. And I know there's a big part of this is warming up the goalie, and you need to account for that. But at the same time, again, being creative about different ways to do that. But again, I want to just tell the coaches, it's not like me coming in with my ideas. I can't just be like, you're wrong. Do it my way. I know. Because people aren't going to listen to me, right? They're just not going to. No, we have a way to do things. So I think you have to build that trust over time, start to implement things that you think are important, try to get in there and do that, and understand that, sometimes it takes time to make those kind of changes. So.
And sometimes you've got to be like Inception, like, what do you think about if we did something like this?
Yeah.
And then before you know it, they start thinking, I made this change. It was great. And they're like, all right, I like where this is going. It's the idea of being best versus right.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's definitely a good point of like just making sure you're not coming in. I mean, you can if maybe you're the HMFIC, the head guy in charge, but
Sure. Yeah. You're going to get a lot
otherwise.
of pushback, though, for sure. Even then, I would say I would look at some practices and then give my coaches some feedback in the association and say, do you realize that our kids are moving, 60% of the time? I want that. How can we get that to 75%, right? Instead of being like, oh, you guys don't know what you're doing. We're doing it this way. I mean, you can do that, especially if you have a lot of credibility coming in. But you're not going to make, necessarily big supporters doing it that way. So again, at the end of the day, you've got to make your choices. Do you come in and sort of come in hot and do it that way, or do you try to build support using evidence, using best practices, like you said, kind of laying it out there and see what the temperature is for it, and versus being like, no, you're wrong. We need to do it this way. So.
Yeah, providing that information. I think education can be a bad way to say things. I feel like a lot of people see education like, whoa, like I need educated. But if you're like providing information, like here's the facts, here's what this looks like, it
Right.
usually comes off better. Like, and following up with what your point here, like I have stats from past years of high school hockey. Like, if you're a first line player who's one of the top players in the state, 20% of the time, the puck, I just do puck touches, like your puck touch turns into a turnover, the other team gets it, whether that be you made a terrible suicide pass to a teammate, whatever it may be, or directly onto the other guy's tape. 20% of the time. Okay, well, your second line, it's about 30% of the time. Your third line is about 35. So I've got like all these points of data. So when I'm talking to players now, I'm like, okay, you say that you're a first line player. Currently on our team, you're at 75% of your puck touches end up in a turnover. Maybe you're just risky.
Maybe,
What do you think when I tell you that a normal player in your position should be about 30% and you're at 75? And that goes back to your point. You've talked about it many times here about reflection, and like that's like the holy grail of like learning, changing all of these things, and just providing that information, and maybe stepping back and let them take control of it into their own sphere.
I think it's big at helping them know how to think about the game. You provide direction, you provide structure, and then you let them do it and give them feedback. I think as coaches, we need to make time to talk with our team after the practice. I think that's extremely valuable. Get them talking, ask them a question. What did you guys think of practice? What did you think of that drill? What was the purpose and how did we do on it? These things accelerate learning. So if you feel like you're getting stuck, it's always good to talk with your team, talk with your leaders on your team, and get their thoughts. It typically is the best way out of getting stuck than to just keep talking at them, because they're going to tune you out. But you definitely want to make time for reflection, because what happens. I mean, they get out of the locker room and they're on the phone. They're talking about other things with their teammates, their friends. They're seeing their parents for the first time that day. Things are going all over the place, and maybe not in a good way. So, you know, the more you can carve out that time, I know we have a little bit more leverage to do this at the USTA being player development, but we ask our players to have a journal. What are your goals? And then they take that 5 minutes to write about their performance on those goals after the practice. And it's also common practice for our coaches to have a conversation with their players after the practice. Now, again, for those that know tennis, they know that tennis is very much in the community. It's one where you teach a lesson and the next lesson's coming on as you finish your previous lesson. So that's where it gets a little challenging, but at the high performance level, you can build in time. And I think it even at youth hockey rec level, you can build in time even to have quick discussions with your team. You know, it's simple things like you've got a squirt team, right? Like, okay, you know, before the practice we talked about, you know, really kind of, you know, trying to make those tape to tape passes. How did we do on that today? Thumbs up, thumbs over, thumbs down. Why do you think it went that way? I know, coach. And you'll get some crazy answers and you'll get some good ones, right? Because they're 10 and under. But it's getting them, you're building that structure in the brain, how to think about the game, how to evaluate themselves on the process, right? Versus a lot of young kids, it was bad or it was good. Well, let's talk about somewhere in between. Like, yeah, we had some bad passes that were bouncing all over the place, but you guys had some good ones too, you know, that were flat. And why were those ones flat and it's bouncing, blowing up on our teammates? And so having those discussions, I think, are crucial for the learning of the players, and they reinforce as a coach your key messages.
Love this. Actually, it's a great word I want to go, which is influence on a team. So specifically hockey. So you're talking about like involving the team, the leaders. I think there's an element of informing the stakeholders. So, you know, in tennis, that's probably going to be a manager, private coaches as well. Obviously, on like a youth team, it'll be the parents, fellow coaches, all of that. Everyone knows that the most influential person on any team is the person who speaks as soon as the coach leaves the room.
Yeah.
So I'm curious on your thoughts about just influencing a team, getting things going in the right direction. You know, we don't want people rowing one direction, another person rowing a different direction, and someone's trying to steer the boat this way, another person trying to steer the boat that way, and all of the problems that come along with that.
Yeah, I think you're trying to communicate with those influencers. You know, when you're talking about youth hockey, younger ages, you're trying to talk to the parents about, it's really about developing the players and learning, having fun. And you know, those things are very important even at older ages, but it, you know, it's in a different frame where now it's more about team play, maybe performing at the older, better levels. But You got to clarify what the expectations are to those influencers. I remember listening to Barry Smith, who was with the Red Wings, and he talked about this, where he had like this target in the middle where your core people, right? They're the people who are bought into the mission. And they got the same philosophy. The coaches are all in. And then you have like this next group that they're in, but maybe they don't have the same level of influence. So they're kind of following the leaders. And then you have this outer ring that's on the fence, right? And that outer ring, they're 1 foot in, 1 foot out, you know, not quite sure. And then you have this most outer ring, excuse me, this most outer ring that, you know, they're resistant. They don't buy in maybe to the style of play or what messages are getting. And so you want to try to move as many players you can into those inner two rings by explaining why you're doing what you're doing, getting them to communicate with you, you know, asking them questions, talking about things, getting their opinions. Hey, how could that game be better? How might we adjust this game to work on this? And that makes them a part of the process, right? They feel like they're a part of the decision-making, then they own it more than it's just being told to them what to do. And again, you know, That it depends on what level you're coaching at, what age you're coaching at, how you do that, and that's a whole, probably another podcast. But just know that the younger you go, the more simple it is, and the more structure you have to provide, excuse me, typically. And the older you go, you can let go of some of that structure and that control and give more to the players and let them help you define. But you still have to guide, right? What are the expectations? How are we doing things as a team? To me, that's important. You want your players to feel like it's their team and they know why they're doing what they're doing. So.
I think that's a key point. Giving away control to the players. There's many ways to do that. At the youngest ages, maybe the players bringing in their own bag to the locker room. Parents stop at the lobby, and then the player takes control as they go into, the area to prepare and get dressed. There's a million different little ways we can do this. I'm a big fan of having the older people pick up the pucks. I'm like, the freshmen and rookies have enough stress in their lives. Like, us older folks are probably a little more locked in and have the ability to control our emotions and stress. We should be the ones maybe picking up the pucks after warm-ups, not the traditional rookies and freshmen. So, like, finding ways to do that and serve, figure out how to serve others at the end of the day.
That's a big part of serve.
MLK Day, right? That's this weekend. I always butcher the quote, but it's like, the biggest question is life is what are you doing for others? So similar way here. We've talked about it in many themes of today of like, how do we best serve our teammates, whether it be skating for them, they're having a bad shift, like it's okay, let that one go. How do we elevate others, all that kind of stuff, and just building our influence in a positive way. Controlling, guiding, mentoring, and that can be intra squad. That can be coaches to players, can be coach to coaches in many different ways. And just finding ways, and like this podcast and newsletter, all about ways to do it better. How can
Yeah.
we do that? So,
Just
last little
one.
bit, yeah,
Sorry.
follow up.
Your thoughts are getting so many thoughts, but one thing I think of is coach listening to this and like, yeah, that is a great thing because it is. But you can actionize this. I don't even know if that's a word, but let's say you're in a locker room with your team and you ask a player, like, what's one of your goals that you're working on? And they say, whatever, right? And then you look to the guy beside him and say, well, how can you help him do that? What's your role in helping him achieve that goal? And then you flip it, like, well, what's one of your goals? And how can you? I need to do that more because I love doing that because it just breeds that in this together that you're looking for. I'm not just here for me. We're in this together because if we lift all of ourselves up. Together, we're going to be way much better if I'm just focused on getting mine. And so I want to help you achieve your goals. You're going to help me. And when we state that, we state it publicly, there's a lot more accountability for that as well.
Yeah, the old accountability buddies, the
Yeah.
accountability buddy system.
It works so well.
Yeah, and you think about it, like a lot of times when you see one player come out of an area, usually there's two or three that are coming with them. It's not just one coming out of an area. It's that idea of like that sparring partner. Like you need someone to help push you. You need someone to help keep you accountable to doing the right things. I'm gonna go real meta here. Yeah, a lot of times, when you look at studies of people who live long, healthy lives, the studies show it's usually they've got a spouse that's riding the journey with them. So actually being married helps keep people healthier longer because they have someone to help push them in the right direction in some shape or form, whether that be a push or a pull or whatever it may be. And same thing with influence on our teams.
Really good point. I like that. I think that this is one of the reasons why we have a national team development program, why we have USTA player development, was that concept that you want to bring the better players together to push one another and lift each other up, right? And let them train together, let them play together. That's a big concept in player development. So again, there's a lot to be said for that. And you're putting those kinds of players in that environment. A lot of times you can get over that ego of I'm the best player, and I got to get my goals to, hey, what are we doing for this team? And it's a constant messaging with the coaching staff, with the leaders on the team, really reinforcing that. So.
Yeah, or just like the older players or someone who's been there showing like here's what it takes, here's what we need to do. I find that's another big piece of like a lot of times it's mixing of the ages that actually help both the older and the younger person. And there's we could do a full episode on that. So I'm gonna end it here because we've got a really long conversation. I want to make sure people are able to get it on the ride too, and then back from the rink. But Larry, thank you so
A
much for
long
coming
ride
on.
indeed.
Anything you want to add at the end here? You got 30 seconds, all yours.
I appreciate it, Greg, and I really appreciate you having me on. I think, in this coaching journey that you just got to keep looking for ways to make yourself better. And oftentimes that's not in a new drill. It's actually in the way that you're communicating, how you're leading, how you're organizing things, how you're interacting with other people. And that to me is where you can make huge leaps and gains in your coaching. And then on the mental side, there's so much now going on in mental performance and mental training and mental health that diving into that area, what helps, not only what makes people tick, motivates them, but really what helps them be resilient and be strong and healthy. How can we make that a part of what we do every single day? So that's where I'd end. It's been a lot of fun, Greg, and thanks for having me on.
That concludes this week's episode. Thanks for joining us here at Hockey IQ. If you haven't already, take a quick moment to hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and drop a review. If you want to be a great teammate, even recommend us to a friend. You can follow us at Hockey's Arsenal on Twitter and Instagram. Check out the website, hockeysarsenal.com, where you can subscribe to the weekly newsletter. You won't regret it. Catch your beauts here next week for a brand new episode.